Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Save big money on everything for your next project at Menards. Update your home with Palmero vinyl plank flooring. It provides a genuine weathered wood look that complements any decor and clicks together for easy installation. It's waterproof, scratch and dent resistant, making it perfect for active households. Save big money on our wide variety of flooring options at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Chronicles, where today we're going to be talking all about The Inimitable Jeeves by P.G. Woodhouse. So the story behind this one is that I've just had a nice week off, and I've been over, blazing summer sun and everything over in Margate in Kent by the seaside. And I thought to myself, well, what reading material do I have that would be a good bit of work to do, of course, you know, ready for presenting this Chronicles, but also something that is just very whimsical, very charming, very English, you know, and the sort of thing that might be quite fun reading whilst you are on the beach or just taking in the sun. And P.G. Woodhouse seemed like the ideal options from amongst the things that I'd had on my shelf. And the other thing as well is just to admit, this is actually the first time I've ever read P.G. Woodhouse before. Of course, I'm very, very well acquainted with how famous the Jeeves and Wooster characters are. No doubt, of course, in large part because of the very successful series that Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie did in the 1990s, which, again, I've only just started to actually see now. But it's all very charming. It's incredibly quaint. It's very, very inoffensive. And really what you find in here is a great swan song to a dying era, that Edwardian interwar era of, you know, the high ideals of British manners, of etiquette, of fashion, of some feeling of actual confidence in British society at the time, even as Bertram Wooster goes about and is just totally oblivious to all of the sort of social disturbances that are going on around him as he sort of wanders through it all with blissful ignorance, very self-absorbed in his own what seem to be quite trivial problems by comparison. But having said all of that, it's not at all malicious. Though it is indeed satirical, you can tell it's been done with a lot of charm and a good degree of fondness for the former years of P.G. Woodhouse's life that he knew so well. And so let's just talk a little bit about Woodhouse, shall we, to begin with. So Pelham Grenville Woodhouse was born in 1881 in Guildford, as his mother was just visiting a sister there at the time, and he was born slightly premature. And so he comes along as the third son of the family. Although it has to be said, his life was, I mean, in many ways, it was quite typical for the time. And this is something that we touched on when we talked about Kipling, when I covered Kim. But Woodhouse was very much a product of empire. His father, Henry Ernest Woodhouse, besides coming from a cadet branch of the Earls of Kimberley, which was a peerage that was created in the 1860s. His father was also a magistrate in the British colony of Hong Kong. And so, a lot like with Kipling and India, Woodhouse spent a lot of time away from his own parents. He never really got to know his own parents in any great real sense. So he was born in 81, immediately taken off to be in Hong Kong, where he spent the first 2 years of his life very much in the care of a Chinese nurse. And then at the age of two, along with his two elder brothers, he was sent back to England. So that in that same way as Kipling, you know, even though you're in an administrative position for the British Empire, that you go back to England and you learn and discover something of, you know, the motherland and why it's a bee's knees and why it's worth defending and all that good stuff. And so though in Wodehouse going back to England, it wasn't quite as fraught with trauma as it was for Kipling growing up in a, quite an oppressive household. In this occasion, you know, Wodehouse found himself being flopped about between all sorts of nannies and aunts and relatives. And so though it wasn't terrible, it certainly wasn't stable in any meaningful sense. And this left Kipling with a great deal of time to allow his imagination to flourish. He, from his earliest years, he always dreamed of becoming a writer. And he was a huge fan of J.M. Barrie, of Kipling himself, of Dickens, of Arthur Conan Doyle. And there's certainly something in the Jeeves and Wooster formula that is a little bit, you know, Doyle-esque, in the way that you always know that Holmes is going to solve the case at the end of the novel, in the same way that you know that Jeeves is always going to bail out Bertie out of whatever troubles he's in. The drama and the fun of it is in the how. And so even though it's, you know, the Jeeves and Worcester stories have a very set formula to them, they're never dull. And that's something that even within this one book alone, which I suppose I should just say as well, this The Inimitable Jeeves is not the first introduction to these characters. Jeeves originally appeared in 1915 as part of a short story that was published in the Saturday Evening Post called Extricating Young Gussie. And at that point was only a very, very small part. And then over a few, the next coming years, Jeeves found his way into becoming a fully formed character along with Bertie, and there was a collection of short stories called My Man Jeeves, which I believe was around 1919, but not all of those stories within that collection were actually Jeeves and Worcester stories. Some of them focused on another character called Reggie Pepper. And so I've chosen The Inimitable Jeeves because it was the first one when it was published in 1923, to be entirely dedicated to the Bertie Worcester and the Reginald Jeeves characters. And they are very much, you can tell, originally conceived of short stories. So Wodehouse does a quite an able job of sewing them together and giving them a bit of a through line. And it all just adds to the drama and whimsy of the entire piece. Just watching Bertie just go from trouble to trouble, watching Jeeves keep getting him out of them. And also as well in those the comedy that comes from where the relationship sours between the two of them a little bit, and Bertie kind of having to strike out on his own with his very limited personal intelligence. It's very, very good, and I'll look forward to saying more about it. But there is more to just say about Wodehouse as well, because he did have a very, very interesting life. One thing to say is the fact that when he was 12, Wodehouse was happy enough to go to Dulwich College in London. And he basically describes these next few years, his teenage years, as just the most heavenly of his entire life. And I think it's one of the reasons why you can certainly see, as he was mingling with, you know, very affluent children, you know, children from affluent families, and that sort of like boyhood camaraderie and, you know, the posh tricks that they'd all get up to, and, you know, the sort of lingo that the upper classes would speak with. A lot of this really came to the fore for him here, and he got a real taste of that. And you can feel all of that very passionately expressed in the novels. The other thing as well is to say that when he was 19, unlike his elder brothers, he wasn't able to go to Oxford. He had originally been hoping to go to Oxford, but his father's pension, after serving as a magistrate in Hong Kong, had basically been given to him in Indian rupees, which were, of course, not half as valuable against the exchange of the British pound. And so they found that when it came to it, they simply didn't have the money and the means to send young Pelham to Oxford as he'd been hoping to. Having said all of that, Wodehouse approached it with a sort of flippant, oh, well, that's just what it is and just better get on with things attitude that he seemed to have embraced throughout most of his life. Even when he had, I mean, he had in moments of genuine, remarkable renown and success, and at some point was, you know, a true celebrity in the interwar period of British society. And also as well in America as well, he had his first trip to America. He'd always been fascinated by America and had a very romantic ideal of it, and ended up having his first trip to New York in 1904. And it turned out to be as good as he'd hoped it would be. And he had a really lovely time there. And ever since then, his trips to America became more and more frequent. In fact, in the second part of this novel, which I'll cover next week, Bertie actually does go off to New York as well, which is all very fun, and he flops about with theatre playwrights and theatre goers, and that was a world that Woodhouse came to know very well in America. In fact, he ended up climbing so high through the careers of writers and, you know, connections that he knew, that he ended up towards the end of the 20s even writing for Hollywood for a brief stint as well. And so he was very, very successful in his own time. But all of this, as he's becoming more unsuccessful, as more of these celebrated works and short stories on Jeeves and Wooster are coming out, and many other characters besides for many other works, he was prolific. He wrote well over 80 novels or 80 works by the end of his life, basically writing about a novel a year. Well, it all kind of came to a head in the end of the 1930s when a somewhat minor event called World War II broke out. And Woodhouse at the time had been living in France. A lot of the reason for this was to get away from the oppressive tax policies of Britain and America at the time. And so Woodhouse had sent himself over to northern France, where he was living a very peaceful life with his wife at the time. And even though there had obviously been talk and indeed a declaration of war, and that the Nazis were on the march, Woodhouse thought he was perfectly safe in France and that nothing would come of it, because he put his trust in the Maginot Line. And not to Norm Macdonald it, but I don't know if any of y'all are history buffs, but the Maginot Line didn't end up doing much of a good job in the end in stopping the German invasion. And so as a consequence of this, Woodhouse found the Nazis at his door. And after they came to realise what a celebrity they'd actually happened upon, living a very quiet life in France, eventually he was taken back to Berlin and allowed to perform some radio for British and American audiences. Now, these were not of a political nature in any way. In fact, I will just read you a short excerpt from one of them, where he simply says, "Young men starting out in life have often asked me, how can I become an internee? Well, there are several methods. My own was to buy a villa in Le Torquay on the coast of France and stay there until the Germans came along. This is probably the best and simplest system. You buy the villa and the Germans do the rest." And a lot of the substance of these radio broadcasts were very much in that very Woodhousean sort of glibness and joviality. But unfortunately, on this occasion, that kind of Woodhousean humour didn't go down very well with the British public right now, given that these were being broadcast at a time when, you know, German-English relations were kind of at an all-time low after the Battle of Britain. And, you know, of course, untold suffering had happened over the, not just World War II, of course, but the decades between the Brits and the Germans. And so the British public didn't take it very lightly that Woodhouse was now just being quite airy-fairy and seemingly naive in just, you know, allowing the Germans to broadcast for him. And so all of this really soured things. And as a result of it, Woodhouse never actually returned to Britain ever again for fear of, for fear of actual prosecution. Though Orwell and many other figures will come to his defence in saying that in desperate circumstances of the time, it was excusable to be angry at what Woodhouse did, but to go on denouncing him 3 or 4 years later and more to let an impression remain that he acted with conscious treachery is not excusable. But nonetheless, the stigma stayed with Woodhouse very much till the end of his life in 1975, though fortunately for him, the Queen knighting him just a few months before he passed away at the age of 93 did do something to rejuvenate his, his public image. But all of this is to say that his works never stopped being adored throughout his life, and he never stopped being successful, and he never stopped writing. His works were and still continue to be adored for the classic English character that they have, in many ways of an almost picturesque, idealistic era of Englishness and confidence in society. And, you know, a civilization that was kind of firing on all cylinders in a way, where everyone had a place to get on with whatever was their particular inkling. You know, whether that was Bertie Wooster's being a part of the idle rich and, you know, dining at the Ritz and visiting country houses and pottering off to France and enjoying, you know, not really having any meaningful aspirations in life. Or as well, you know, those of the lower orders who are also find themselves being quite celebrated in Woodhouse's novels as well. There's something for everyone in these novels. And so with that, let's start talking about the first half of this. I've split it into two and I'll do the second half next week, just because in the book actually being a collection of short stories, it is, even though it's quite brisk and you skip along with it, it's very eventful because it's constantly moving on to new things. So I split it up. We'll talk about the first half this week, and there's already plenty in there to say. And so let's get on with it. During those last precious decades of British confidence, one could go about in the dwindling years of polite society as what was termed the idle rich. The rich pleasure of London, with its casinos and restaurants, its parks and performances, all waiting to be embraced by men like Bertie Wooster, the resident of flat 3A Berkeley Mansions, Berkeley Square, London W1. Mr. Wooster is an unrepentant bachelor, much to the chagrin of his tyrannous relations. But with his eminently capable valet, Jeeves, by his side, he never finds himself in trouble for long. "Morning, Jeeves," I said. "Good morning, sir," said Jeeves. He put the good old cup of tea softly on the table by my bed, and I took a refreshing sip. Just right, as usual. Not too hot, not too sweet, not too weak, not too strong, not too much milk, and not a drop spilt in the saucer. A most amazing cove, Jeeves. So dashed competent in every respect. I've said it before and I'll say it again. I mean to say, take just one small instance. Every other valet I've ever had used to barge into my room in the morning while I was still asleep, causing much misery. But Jeeves seems to know when I'm awake by a sort of telepathy. He always floats in with the cup exactly 2 minutes after I come to life. Makes a deuce of a lot of difference to a fellow's day. Just as the day appears as though it's going to be roaringly cheerful, Jeeves informs his employer that Bingo Little, Bertie's friend from his school days, wishes to meet him to discuss an urgent matter. When the two gentlemen are later together, Bingo giddily tells his pal that he's in love. "You'd better come along and meet her at lunch," he said, looking at his watch. "A ripe suggestion," I said. "Where are you meeting her? At the Ritz?" "Near the Ritz." He was geographically accurate. Before long, the two are burrowed into a good, honest, working-class tea room, which engenders a great amount of distress in the aloof Bertie. Just as the two find themselves sat down, a plain and pretty waitress comes to take their order. "You see I'm wearing the tie," said Bingo. "It suits you beautiful," said the girl. "Personally, if anyone had told me that a tie like that suited me, I should have risen and struck them on the muzzard, regardless of their age and sex. But poor old Bingo simply got all flustered with gratification and smirked in the most gruesome manner." "Well, what's it going to be today?"
asked the girl, introducing the business touch into the conversation. Bingo studied the menu devotedly. I'll have a cup of cocoa, cold veal and ham pie, slice of fruitcake and a macaroon. Same for you, Bertie. I gazed at the man, revolted. That he could have been a pal of mine all these years and think me capable of insulting the old tum with this sort of stuff cut me to the quick. Or how about a bit of hot steak pudding with a sparkling limado to wash it down, said Bingo. You know, the way love can change a fellow is really frightful to contemplate. This chappie before me, who spoke in that absolutely careless way of macaroons and limado, was a man I had seen in happier days telling the head waiter at Claridge's exactly how he wanted the chef to prepare his sole frite au gourmet au champignon, and saying he would jolly well sling it back if it wasn't just right. Ghastly. A roll and butter and a small coffee seemed the only things on the list that hadn't been specially prepared by the nastier-minded members of the Borgia family for people they had a particular grudge against, so I chose them and Mabel hopped it. Bingo is insistent that he is head over heels for Mabel. The snag is that his uncle, Mortimer Little, is sure to cut off his allowance if he marries a commoner. But Bingo appeals to the school days and old times, and Bertie agrees to find a way to persuade old Little. The inimitable Jeeves devises a strategy.
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
Hi, everybody. It's James and Andy here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two-fourths of a group of people who love facts, and we love to find new facts, and we come here every week and tell each other about them. For instance, Andy, did you know that one of the world's oldest cycling road races is getting much harder because people keep stealing the road?
I want to know more already, but I'm instead going to tell you my new fact, which is that some ancient coffins from the 17th century have faces.
The coffins have faces.
It's really creepy.
Not just on the inside.
No.
Wow. If you like the sound of those facts, or indeed facts in general, then come and find us, No Such Thing as a Fish, wherever you get your podcasts.